University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Thomas Canby, Senior Science Editor of National Geographic, speaking on Soviets in Space. Canby received his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Virginia and his law degree from George Washington University. He joined the National Geographic staff in 1961. He has written articles for the magazine, including his 1986 piece, Soviets in Space, Are They Ahead? In addition, Canby has addressed topics such as the world food problem, the United States water situation, Skylab, and the earliest Americans. He has received several writing honors, including the 1984 National Society of Professional Engineers Award for the article on satellites.
In the hotel lobbies and in the restaurants, there were many prostitutes in 1986. I could just picture old Gorbachev saying, well, you win some, you lose some. I'm sure you know that the Soviets have a formidable space program. They employ about 600,000 people in it, and that's as many as we employed at the height of our Apollo program during the height of the moon race in the mid-1960s. They spend about nearly $25 billion a year on their space program. That's about the same as we spend, but you have to keep in mind that their GNP is less than half of ours, so the burden on the Soviet citizen is about double. They have a manned space program that has accumulated about 15 man years in space. That's about three times what our program has. They launch nearly 100 rockets a year. That's about five times as many as we launch. Now, it's not all that bad, really, from our point of view. Their satellites don't last as long as ours do. They're not as well made, and the Soviets have to replace them more often. But it's pretty bad, because if it came to a war and we start knocking out each other's satellites, we have few. They could knock them out quickly. They have many. It'd be harder to knock them out, and they can replace them more quickly. At the beginning, I'd like to take you up in space with the cosmonauts to one of their space stations. Have the lights down? Do I have it? Jane does. Oh, great. Very good. This is your standard Soviet rocket. It can send up a pretty good-sized satellite, or it can send up a capsule holding as many as three cosmonauts. It's about 150 feet tall, or long in this case. That's not quite half as high as your state capitol, but that's quite a piece of machinery. You see it now on a gigantic railroad flat car at the Baikonur Cosmodrome, one of three cosmodromes that the Soviets operate. Baikonur is in Kazakhstan in the Central Asian steppe. Here you see a rear view, and you'll see that there are 20 engines, four in the central core and 16 in the strap-on boosters. And all of those engines have to fire in perfect synchronization for the rocket to work. Otherwise, it vibrates itself apart. And by and large, the Russians managed to pull that off. They have about a 3% failure rate, about the same as we've had. I call this the Gulliver picture. Here the rocket is at the pad, and you see all those little Lilliputian technicians wrestling with a big Gulliver rocket. And here it's being erected for launch, tilted upright. And here you have it in place. The side arms are clamping onto it to steady it. If you'll notice, there's a kind of a stem at the top of the rocket, and that is part of the emergency escape mechanism. If there is a fire at the pad, then small rockets go off that are located in that stem, and they yank away the capsule that's holding cosmonauts and hurl it about a mile into the air, and a parachute opens, and they descend to Earth safely, they hope. And true enough, about 15 years ago, They had a fire on the pad, and it was engulfing the stem of the rocket when somebody pushed the right button and touched off the escape mechanism, and it fired the capsule about a mile up and parachuted the cosmonauts to safety. It worked perfectly. This enormous trench is the flame pit, and its purpose is to divert the fireball of the launch away from the control facilities, which are off to your left. Now, here you see three astronauts approaching for a ride, and in reality, this is a hooked-up PR picture that the Soviets took, because in real life, the cosmonauts would be driven to the rocket in a very sterile van, because the last thing the Soviets want to happen is for the cosmonauts to pick up a bug while they're walking to a rocket and get ill in space. Here you see two cosmonauts in a capsule at the top of a rocket. And here is launch, a night launch. You can see that the support arms have folded back from the rocket. I don't know if any of you have ever been to a rocket launch, but the roar is absolutely horrifying. I went to the launch of Apollo 17 and Skylab in the early 70s down at Cape Canaveral, and the press was seated as close as anybody, any visitors, 3 miles away for safety. And the roar was so terrifying that you really thought that the rockets had blown up on the pad. Here's liftoff. And you see those two towers there? Those are lightning rods, giant lightning rods. You have to guard very carefully that your charged rocket isn't struck by lightning. This is their destination, the Soviet space station. The wing-like structures are solar power installations, photovoltaic cells. The space station is about 13 feet in diameter, outside diameter, about 40 feet long. It has a space capsule attached to the end closer to you. The Soviets have launched about half a dozen space stations in the last 15 years, each one in same size as the one before it, but an improvement internally and externally. And crews have visited these stations for ever longer periods of time. The first cruise for a couple of weeks, 3 or 4 weeks the next, then a month, 2 months, 6 months. Recently they got up to 8 months, and now there's one cosmonaut and a two-man crew who's been up a total of 9 months and will probably stay altogether 10 months, come down in December. At the present time, the Soviets have two space stations in orbit. One of them's in mothballs, but could be reactivated. Here we are inside the space station, and cosmonauts, like any other Russians, like to play chess. Now, these chessmen have magnets at their bases because otherwise they would float off into space. You have to keep in mind that we're up in orbit, and we're in a zero-gravity environment. We're weightless. In fact, it looks like that cosmonaut's hair is trying to float off. Normally, you would not often see cosmonauts doing something competitive one against the other. There are terrific emotional strains in space because of the isolation and two or three men confined so closely together for such long periods of time. And normally, a chess player, if he has the urge to play, would play a televised game with somebody on the ground and to avoid tensions. The Soviets have been largely successful with the emotions of the crews, but not totally so. On one flight, after the men had been up for a couple of months, they grew angry at each other, and one went to one end of the space station, one went to the other end, and they pouted for 2 days. In another case, crew had been up a long time and was fatigued, and they grew angry with the guys on the ground. They thought they weren't getting enough attention from the ground control people. And they refused to talk to the people on the ground for a couple of days and would do no work. But by and large, they're good guys and very diligent people. This is big stuff up in space. They get so bored that anything like one guy feeding a cookie to another guy is real hijinks. The man on the left is a cosmonaut named Lebedev, and the cosmonaut on the right is a lady, Svetlana Savitskaya, and she is a very competent cosmonaut. She was the second woman to fly in space. She's the first woman to fly twice in space, and she's a rising star in the Soviet hierarchy of cosmonauts. It wasn't easy for her. The Soviet cosmonauts are real chauvinists, and she had to struggle to carve out a niche, but she's a strong person, and she managed to do it. And now the men are like putty in her hands. On one flight of three guys up in the space station, they've been there a long time, and one cosmonaut began to lose interest in his food. He simply wouldn't eat, and you couldn't blame him because your taste buds don't work well in space, and there's not much incentive to eat. But the people on the ground were concerned because he had a lot of work to do, and he had to keep his caloric intake up. And it just so happened that about the time he was on this sort of hunger strike, three cosmonauts came to visit. A second capsule docked at the space station, and in the crew of the visiting capsule was Savitskaya. And pretty soon, when she got settled in the space station, she did some of the cooking, and the guy who was on a hunger strike ate like a horse. This is a full house indeed. This is a three of those people, of those six people, are the permanent crew, or permanent in a sense crew, of the space station, and the other three are visitors. You can see Savitskaya in the center left. She's a part of the visiting crew. When you have just three people in a space station, the air is kind of thick and unpleasant. And when you get six people in a space station, it is really rank. And they've all complained about it. It's very difficult in a big tin can to avoid that. If you look at the guy on the lower right, you'll notice that he has a fat face. And there's a reason for that. When you go up into orbit, into weightlessness, the blood that was pooled in your legs and lower body sort of moves upward. There's nothing holding it down. And it goes into your upper body and up into your head. It gives you a very unpleasant sinus-like feeling in your head. And it inflates your cheeks, gives you kind of a free facelift. There's a far worse problem in space for your body. Because you are weightless, your muscles don't have to make any effort to haul you around. You don't weigh anything. And as a result, as soon as you leave Earth's gravity, your muscles begin to atrophy. And the cosmonauts are required to work out 2 hours a day. They have a treadmill on the space station, and they have a stationary bicycle that, oddly enough, the bicycle, is, you can't see it, but it's attached to the roof, unquote, of the space station, but it doesn't matter if you're upside down or not. They pedal away for an hour on that. That helps keep them in shape, but it doesn't really do the job. Furthermore, the cosmonauts hate to get to put forth all that effort, all that dull work, and they hate to get dirty because it's hard to get clean again. They hate to be covered with sweat. And as a result, they often cheat and don't do their exercises, and they pay for that when they come down. We'll see later. This is Savitskaya with a fancy blouse on, and that may be small potatoes to us, but that's a big deal up there where nothing's going on. This is Savitskaya on a spacewalk. She was making a repair on the outside of the space station, and what you're seeing is really the first woman to take a spacewalk. Since then, one of our lady astronauts did spacewalk. This is a sketch of the newest of the Soviet space stations. It's called Mir, the Russian word for peace. And from the cutaway, you can see that it's really roomier looking inside than the station we were looking at before, which was an older version, although it's still up there. And the reason this looks roomier is it's really no larger. The station's no larger, but you don't have as much equipment inside to clutter it up. There's really more room for the men to women to drift around in. And the equipment, instead, comes up in special modules that attach to the docking ports. You can see at the left end of the station there are those round openings. Those are docking ports. And you can see a module coming up from the bottom of the sketch. And the station, as it is now in orbit, has one module attached to it, and that is an astronomy observatory. It has a number of, I think, almost half a dozen telescopes of various kinds in it. And one was made in France, and a couple of others were made in Europe. It's pretty soon, it's expected that the Soviets will add another module, and that will be for materials processing, developing materials in space alloys and things that you can't do well in a gravity environment on Earth. Then another one will be added. Let's see, that will be for Earth observations. We're looking down at Earth, making pictures, looking for minerals. And then later on, a fourth will be added, and that will be for medical experiments and for it'll have a greenhouse on board for attempting to grow plants in space. The Soviets have tried for years to grow plants in space, and they have some luck. They get the plants to come up, but they generally wither shortly after they do come up. And it's very difficult. One problem is that there's no up and no down there, and the plants really don't know which way to go. Now we're in mission control, and this is in a suburb outside of Moscow. And you'll see there's a TV image in the upper right-hand corner of the slide, and it looks like it's showing the space station astronauts performing a spacewalk. And I imagine that's true because you have so many people here at these consoles. Normally you wouldn't have that many on duty at mission control. You'll see on that large central screen that there are two tracks there. And those are the tracks of the two space stations that the Soviets are now operating. One is, as they say, mothballed. And the space stations take a roughly equatorial orbit. They go back and forth across the equator as they go around the Earth. Yeah, it takes an awful lot of manpower to people on the ground to operate a space program. They have tens of thousands of people in Moscow, all across the Soviet Union, and on ships all around the world who take care of information coming from the 150 satellites that they have working up there, from the space station, that track everything. It's just an enormous effort. And it's also kind of boring duty at times for the people on the ground. The guys in space are the heroes and the prima donnas, and the guys on the ground are doing a lot of work and not getting much credit for it. And sometimes frictions arise between the people on the ground and the people in the space station. And the Soviets keep a team of psychologists on hand all the time to try to keep that to a minimum. The Soviets aren't the only people who are looking at their space activities. This is our North American Space Command in NORAD, deep in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs. And on that console, one of the officers there is following the path of one of the space stations. And it's here that we get our radar sends warning of their missile tests, for example. We have radars all across the northern boundaries of Canada and Greenland and Great Britain. And the Soviets test about 400 or 500 missiles a year, and they're picked up by the radars, and the warning comes here. And the day I visited this place, these tunnels in the Cheyenne Mountain, two missiles were fired, and the red light flashed, and the warnings, alarms went to the White House and to Ottawa, Canada, because Canada's our partner in NORAD. You can watch the Soviets, too, if you want to. This is a time exposure taken from Washington, D.C., and those are the tracks of the two space stations. They're moving from right to left. If you look at the lower track, you'll see just above it a line, light line coming perpendicularly down, and that is the track of one of our satellites that is orbiting over the poles from pole to pole, like our weather satellites do. And you can see there's a lot of traffic up there. Now a crew has left the space station and is returning to Earth. And they land just a few hundred miles from where they take off in the Kazakhstan steppe. You can see how bleak it looks in this winter scene. Here's a close-up. They like to say that if that chute doesn't open, it can ruin your whole day. They've arrived. The dust you see is not so much from the impact, but thrown up by retro-op rockets that cushion the impact of the space capsule. The capsule has sticking out from the bottom of it an antenna about 3 feet long, like your automobile radio antenna. And as soon as that probe makes contact with the surface of the ground, two retro rockets fire and help cushion the impact. And they send up that debris. I was going to feel sorry. I think that's some poor farmer's wheat field. I'm sure it is a wheat field, but it's probably a collective, and nobody cares too much. There you can, they've landed, and as soon as they land, people just appear almost out of the soil. It's actually a big event. And I can see the big line up there. The people in white are medical personnel, and they are very much needed at these landings. You can see the two craters dug by the retro rockets. When they land, they are pitifully weak. Some of them are almost like jelly from the atrophying of their muscles. And they can't stand, and often they cannot sit up unassisted. You can see that they've put a frame around the space capsule. It's hard to see, but they've put a frame around the space capsule to hold it upright. It has a rounded bottom, and you have to prop it up. And they're, one cosmonaut is out of the capsule, and they're scooping out a second one there. They will rush those guys to a hospital. Here you see them giving a brief interview to the press before they are rushed to the hospital. They're glad to be back. There's no question of that. When they get to the hospital, they are able to swim in about a day. They have the strength to swim, start swimming. They can walk usually in about 3 days, and then in about 3 weeks, they seem to be more or less okay. But everybody agrees there are a lot of medical questions to be answered before you know that you're safe for long-duration flights in space, like a trip to Mars. This recently just returned cosmonaut is standing up, as you can see, and that means that he was on a short voyage, probably just a week up in space, probably just visited a space station briefly. And he is following a time-tested tradition. That is, when you land, the commander of the mission takes a piece of chalk and signs the charred side of the space capsule, and the space capsule then is taken to a space museum in the hometown of that cosmonaut, and it goes on exhibit. And every Soviet town of any size has a space museum. There are about 175 in the USSR. The Soviets have an international program they call InterCosmos, and in that program they invite people from the satellite countries and from their closest allies to come to send a cosmonaut and a backup cosmonaut for training, and then for the lead guy to fly in space. And so far I think a dozen people have come from the satellite and allied countries and trained and flown with the Soviets. And this is one of those persons. He is from Mongolia. And I've never been interested in collecting autographs, but I met him during my coverage, and I went up and got his autograph because I figured there's probably no rarer person on Earth than a Mongolian who's been into space. Now we're into training. They have a lot of training, just as our astronauts do. These guys are in a centrifuge, and the purpose is to accustom the inner ear to weightlessness and to the funny movements you get in space. The man on the right is part of that InterCosmos program I was telling you about. He is a French cosmonaut, and he flew in 1982, and I think he'll fly again next year. When the Soviets started their manned space program, they had no idea what cosmonauts would be subjected to up in space, and so they devised a horrendously rigorous training program. They would put their, this was back in the mid and late 1950s, they would put the cosmonaut trainee in his space suit and subject him to heat for 24 hours at a time, and they would make them do just countless parachute jumps to make sure they were really with it and extend the idea of a free fall and that kind of thing. They would put them in isolation chambers for as long as 2 weeks. And it's widely believed that two or three cosmonauts died during that early training. It shows you the caution of the Soviets. And another example of that is during the flight of Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, in 1959, the Soviets weren't sure if a person could really think when he was up in space, you know, what would be the effect of weightlessness and radiation and things on the brain. Even though they sent animals up, they really couldn't tell that. So when Gagarin flew, he had absolutely no responsibilities whatsoever. In fact, he was forbidden to touch anything in the spacecraft. He was strictly a passenger. More training. One of the best ways to simulate weightlessness on Earth is to immerse in a tank of water. And these guys are in their spacesuits, and they are rehearsing at a tank of water in Moscow. They're rehearsing a repair of a space station, a spacewalk, to do something on the outside of the space station. This is another bit of training, an emergency landing at sea. And the guy on the left is a Cuban who trained in the Intercosmos program and flew in space. Here's some training for landing in the wilderness. Doesn't look too bad. Some more wilderness training. All of the cosmonauts or heroes are just about demigods in the Soviet Union. The Russians just love them, and they love no one more than Yuri Gagarin in the center. This picture was taken not too long after his flight. And when you travel in Moscow, you see almost as many pictures and busts of Gagarin as you see of Lenin. It's unbelievable, the adoration they feel for him. And I don't know if you recall, but he was killed in a light plane crash in 1969, just 10 years after his flight. And when word of that reached Moscow over the radio, the people just sort of unconsciously left their homes and drifted down into Red Square. And there were tens of thousands of people just standing silently in Red Square, each of them holding a flower or two. The Soviets have had their share of space disasters, and in fact, their record for safety is not quite as good as ours, but both countries have excellent records by, I think, any reckoning. There have been 116 manned flights since manned space flight began, and in all that time, with all those flights, there have been only three fatal disasters. Here you see a picture of Vladimir Komarov, and he was descending by himself in a space capsule about 15 years ago, and as he was descending through, it just reached the atmosphere from space, and his space capsule began to twist in space just at the time that parachute came out. The parachute became snarled, and his space capsule plunged onto the surface of the Earth at about 300 miles an hour, and he was the first person to die in space. The here you his remains. He was cremated. His remains or his ashes are in the Kremlin wall, and here his wife is placing flowers there. Here you have three cosmonaut luminaries. On the lower left is Gagarin, and behind is Valentina Tereshkova, and she was the first woman to fly in space. But she was never able to find a niche to crack the chauvinism of the cosmonauts. She never found a niche and never fitted in. And she left the cosmonaut corps, and I tried to interview her when I was in Moscow in 1982, and she was just unavailable. The man on the right is Alexei Leonov, and Leonov was the first person to walk in space, to leave his capsule on a tether and float around as sort of a human satellite. He, next to Gagarin, is probably the greatest of the cosmonaut heroes. You see busts of him, paintings of him. In fact, he himself is a painter, too, in watercolor. Here is Leonov at Star City, the cosmonaut training center where I met him. As you can see, he's a one-star general, and he's a strong and resourceful man. He speaks some English because he participated in the joint Soviet-U.S. venture in 1975, Apollo-Soyuz. We launched an Apollo spacecraft. They launched a Soyuz. The two docked in space, met in space, and the five people involved, Soviet the cosmonauts and our guys, conducted experiments for a couple of days. As I mentioned, Leonov is a powerhouse and a very brave person. He's had three narrow escapes from death. The first one was during those parachute jumps I described during training. He had made a jump, and as he was descending, he pulled the ripcord, and the chute wouldn't open. And he kept pulling and pulling, and finally he realized that the metal frame that holds the chute to him was bent, preventing the chute from opening. And just at the last second, he bent that steel back with his bare hands, and the chute flew open and just barely caught it in time. On the flight that he made when he made the spacewalk, he got ready for the spacewalk inside the space capsule by inflating his spacesuit with atmosphere, and he wriggled out of the space capsule on his tether and floated out there for 10 or 12 minutes. And then he came back and started to re-enter the capsule, and he realized to his horror that he couldn't bend his body enough at the waist to scramble back into the capsule. The pressure of the atmosphere in his spacesuit was just too much. This is something you couldn't practice on Earth. And so he struggled and struggled to bend enough to get back in the capsule. He was bathed in perspiration. His heart was pounding. They keep track of your heartbeat on those occasions. And finally he realized that the only way he could ever get back in was to release some of the pressure in his atmosphere inside the spacesuit. So he pushed the button and released it, even though he was threatened with the bends from doing that. And that allowed him to bend enough at the waist to work his way back into the capsule, and he did not get the bends. On the way back from that trip, as if he hadn't had enough problems, they were about to descend in a landing, he and his the pilot of the capsule, and they realized that the automatic landing apparatus, all maneuvers in space are automated, had failed, and they would have to land manually. Well, the Soviets had never done that before, but they did their best, and they actually did a pretty good job. They came down about 3,000 miles off target, but they descended safely, and when they landed, they realized that they'd landed in mountains. They were actually in the Ural Mountains, and there was deep snow on the ground. So they got pretty cold inside the capsule, so they thought they'd get out and light a fire. So they scrambled out of the capsule, and as they were lighting a fire, they saw these shapes sort of coming out of the woods and getting closer and closer to them. It was a pack of wolves. So they dove back into the capsule and cowered there all night. And at noon the next day, a rescue party finally found them. I've mentioned to you that the busts of the cosmonauts are everywhere. This is one of the nicest parks in Moscow. And there's a row of busts. You see only three of them here. There are a couple more off to the right. That's Gagarin on the left, and Tereshkova, and Komarov, the guy who was killed. And it's a custom that when a bride and groom are married, they will come and toss a bouquet at the statue of their favorite cosmonaut. You see that here. And you see a lot of that in the Soviet Union. It's a very common thing. It's hard to realize the place that the cosmonauts hold in the feelings of the Soviet people. This is a shrine at the place where Gagarin's plane crashed. It's quite a mecca for the Russians to come and mourn. That's about 100 miles outside of Moscow on a farm. Here you have three male cosmonauts, and in the center is Gagarin's mother, and to her right is Gagarin's sister, and giving her a big bear hug is Alexei Leonov, the guy who did the spacewalk, had all his problems. This is Moscow's leading space monument. The a rocket soars aloft atop a great plume of fire and smoke there. It's all done in titanium, the material that spacecraft are made out of. That statue is of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, and he is the great a Russian theoretician of space who did his work about the turn of the century, made the calculations that got the Russians going in their colonization of space. The banners, the people you see, are young cosmonauts. This happens to be the 25th anniversary of Gagarin's flight, and the young cosmonauts have gathered at the foot of the monument, and they recite their tributes to Gagarin, and they sing songs and give talks, and I watched them for about an hour in the rain, and about half of them wept while they were doing it. They are part of the Young Pioneers, which is a great national youth group in the Soviet Union, and they're kind of the best and the brightest of the Young Pioneers. This is the arsenal of the Soviet rockets, minus one, that I'll get to. And if you'll take a look at the rocket on the left, that short one, that's the world's first ICBM. And that first fired in 1957. And that's the rocket that sent up Sputnik in 1957. The Soviets used that rocket for just time after time, steadily, until a year ago when they finally have discarded it from their active arsenal. But it just illustrates the habit they have that if something works, just keep using it. They have a mind to economy. You'll notice that the rockets to the right of it, the five rockets to the right, or four, have the same configuration of the first stage. And it's true that to make bigger rockets, the Soviets took that initial ICBM and just added other stages to it. The rocket that you saw being launched earlier in the talk is that one, the fourth from the left. I think I got my directions wrong here, but anyway, the fourth from the left is that rocket you all saw being launched. That's a workhorse of the line up here. You might have read in the papers recently that the Soviets conducted a missile test, and the missile landed a few hundred miles from Hawaii, and the U.S. made a great protest of that, rightly so. Well, the rocket that the missile we're complaining about, was very similar to the third rocket from the right. These rockets are not used as missiles. These are used to send up satellites, but they're all largely adaptations of military rockets. And in fact, in the Soviet space program, there's no distinction between military and civil. The rocket to the far right, it has been the workhorse for a long time, their heaviest rocket for a long time, and that's the rocket that sends up their space stations. The upper stage of that rocket, the top of it, nearly the top, before it tucks in, is 13 feet in diameter, just the diameter of the space station. That's called a Proton. It's this Proton rocket that the Soviets would like to have the United States customers lease for rocket launches. The Soviets are trying to take advantage of our rocket problems by offering to launch rockets commercially. And they offer a good bargain. They say they will launch our satellites for about $30 million apiece, and it normally costs about $60 or $65 million to launch by one of our rockets or by the shuttle or by the French rocket Ariane. So far, the U.S. government has turned thumbs down on that. I mentioned that I was showing you every rocket but one, and this is the one you didn't see. And that's because this is something new. It flew for the first time after my article came out, and then the lineup didn't include it. This is their new heavy lift rocket. It's called Energia, and it can lift about 120 tons. That's about four times what our space shuttle can lift, or about four times what that Proton rocket could lift. That is a mighty, mighty rocket. It's got a large central fuel tank with engines at the bottom and four strap-ons. The Soviets had a terrible time developing a heavy lift rocket. They'd been trying for about 20 years to perfect one. You know, we had the Saturn V back in the 60s for our space program, and the Russians were trying to develop such a rocket, and they blew up several on the pad. One of them is believed to have killed scores of technicians when it blew up. They just couldn't handle all that power and the strain on the engines. Now they seem to have perfected. That test that they made in May was successful, except for an upper stage failure, but basically the rocket was successful. And as I say, this is the world's most powerful rocket. The U.S. has nothing at all like it. This is the rocket that will launch their space shuttle. In addition to their manned space program, the Soviets have a really good unmanned program, a science program. I better keep track of the time. Ooh, I better speed up. This contraption landed on the moon years ago and chemically sampled the lunar soil, and they call it the flying samovar. This is a moon rover, and they sent several of these up to the moon, and they rolled around, solar-powered, taking lunar samples and analyzing chemically and send data back to Earth. And one of these ran around on this, or crawled around on the surface of the moon for an entire year before it gave out. And that's great engineering. The Soviets have had quite a project with landings on Venus. And Venus is the most hostile of the nearby planets because, you know, it has a terrible atmosphere, a real dense atmosphere. It's scalding hot, and it's largely there's a lot of sulfuric acid in it. The surface of Venus is scalding hot, about 880 degrees Fahrenheit, and yet 13 times the Soviets have been able to lower probes down through that atmosphere and have them operate on the surface of Venus at least for a few minutes. And here you see one of their images of the rubble-strewn surface of Venus. Now, this doesn't, it takes some effort to understand this, but if you look at the lower right, you'll see an object in the water. And this is here because there's some mysteries in the Soviet space program, despite Glasnost, and this is one of them. What is that little spacecraft that we see in the water? And I'll get to the next picture and you'll see it a little better. There it's being hoisted on board ship. This is a small space plane. If you took a Volkswagen Beetle and sort of flattened it out, you'd have this this spacecraft. And four times the Soviets have launched this mystery craft. It's made one orbit each time and landed either three times in the Indian Ocean, once in the Black Sea. The Soviets never acknowledge what it's for. These pictures came, we have these pictures because on one of the recoveries that the Soviets made, an Australian task force was shadowing the Soviet recovery fleet and took these pictures during the recovery. You'll notice that the guys on the rail have gas masks on. That's because the fuel of a spacecraft is highly toxic. There are four or five theories as to what this craft might be. It could be a little space taxi that would take a couple of guys up to a space station or to repair a satellite. It could be a space fighter, sort of a fighter plane for space. It could be a prototype of what will be a larger sort of space shuttle. It could be for testing materials as they go in and out of orbit. Or it could be a weapons carrier, a carry a warhead, and just drop down out of space into an American task force. I mentioned that the Soviets have a rocket now that can launch their shuttle. The Soviets don't admit that they have a shuttle in the works, but our Department of Defense is quite sure they do, and I'm quite sure they do, too, because I'm sure they're spies. In fact, you'll learn now. Here you see their shuttle perched on top of a Bison bomber. They take their shuttle up, test it in the atmosphere, test it for aerodynamics, just like we tested our shuttle on top of B-47s when we were developing it. And during one of these tests, as they were rolling out from the hangar out on the runway to take off, the Bison bomber skidded off the runway into the mud on the side. And before the Soviets could rush out and cover this up with tarpaulins, one of our spy satellites came over and made a picture of it. And word of this has leaked out from the Pentagon, and that's what this sketch is based on. And I think it's a pretty valid sketch. Here you see the shuttle as DOD envisions it, mated to the energy of their big rocket, ready for launch. And it's expected they'll launch the shuttle in about maybe 2 years. It looks very much like our shuttle. They may have taken some of our technology. They actually could get it without the use of spies. You could get it, I think, from through this sort of government printing office, the plans. But it has several improvements on our shuttle. You can improve on something if you see it operate for years like ours has. It'll have, for one thing, it'll have a larger, carry a larger payload. You might have been reading in the newspapers lately about a giant Soviet radar installation near a town called Krasnoyarsk. And this is that installation. It's in the news because it's considered to be a violation by the Soviets of the ABM Treaty of 1972. And this is a monstrous building. It's about 30 stories tall, and on the left face, that sloping face, there are hundreds of radar dipoles. This is a receiver. There's a big transmitter nearby. And using this receiver, the Soviets can detect and probably track a whole lot of missiles at one time should they come over the Soviet Union. And from what I can read, this is indeed a violation of the ABM Treaty. And as a complicated lot of stuff, but as the Washington Post editorialized, it probably should be dismantled. Whoops, wrong direction, I'm sorry. Well, this is what a space reporter does on his day off in Moscow. I know when we get into the Soviet space business, we got to face up to the question of are they ahead or who's ahead? And it's kind of an or the question's not quite germane because we don't really have a space race in the sense that we did during the 1960s, the Boone race. Yet, on the other hand, space is a frontier that will be colonized, and the military stakes of space, it's a military theater that you cannot deny that. Both nations recognize that and are moving into it. So it is reasonable to see where we stand vis-a-vis the Soviets in space. And it looks to me that in the short term, the Soviets are definitely ahead for the short term. They have the experience of manned space flight, three times ours. They have the ground structure to manage their enormous space complex. They have the rockets. They have that new heavy lift rocket. They have all the lineup that you saw, the other rockets, with enormous launch capability. They have a good science program of planetary studies, one that's at least as good as ours. Perhaps the thing that the lead that they enjoy best is their approach to their space program. It's a consistent building block approach. It's pragmatic and economical. They go just step by step into that new frontier. The United States, without a doubt, has vastly superior technology to the Soviets. If we were to adopt the approach that they have, the coherent approach that's well or steadily funded, then I have no doubt that we could catch them in 10 years and pass right by them, just pass by them like they were standing still. But we do have to get our act together with a consistent, coherent program and steady funding. I know you heard here last week a plea that or the idea that the two countries should work together, and I couldn't agree more. There's really no valid reason that I can see that the U.S. and the USSR shouldn't work together on, say, a manned mission to Mars. It's been a pleasure to be here at Wesleyan, and thank you for coming.
Today, University Forum has presented Thomas Canby, Senior Science Editor of the National Geographic. He spoke on Soviets in Space. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.